A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging arts organizations and institutions. Today, we'll hear about another upcoming tribute to Leonard Bernstein as organizations celebrate the centennial of his birth. The Curtis Institute of Music, Opera Philadelphia, and the National Museum of American Jewish History are teaming up for a roundtable discussion about how Bernstein's thoughts on identity shaped his opera, A Quiet Place, which will be performed in March. I'll speak with representatives from the organizations about this work and some of the questions that will be examined. I'll also provide an update on the latest news about Rider University's plans to sell Westminster Choir College. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. A Beijing-based company that runs bilingual K-12 schools in China and has been expanding into sports and arts academies is seeking to buy Westminster Choir College from Rider University for $40 million. The announcement by Rider of the non-binding arrangement this week with Beijing Kaiwen Educational Technology Company was the first time the university has revealed the name of the interested party or a price tag. No further timeline was given, and additional details of the agreement were not made public. In the statement, Rider President Gregory Del Omo said Kaiwen's proposal was rooted in an interest in the Westminster name and keeping the school in Princeton. Rider last year announced its plans to sell Westminster and its campus, backing off an initial proposal to close the Princeton-based campus and move Westminster's choral and music education programs to its main Lawrence campus. The prospect of a sale of the nearly 100-year-old choir college, whose choirs have performed with major U.S. orchestras and sung on Grammy-winning albums, alarms some alumni and parents, prompting several lawsuits challenging the legality of any sale that might put its legacy at risk. According to the English-language version of its website, Kaiwen Academy, a subsidiary of Kaiwen Education Technology, operates elementary, middle, and high school programs on its Beijing campus. Its vision is to educate students, quote, to become open-minded, inquiring, courageous, reflective, principled, and caring citizens. The company changed its name from Jingsu Zhongtai Bridge Steel Structure in December. Earlier this month, it announced an agreement with the Manchester City Football Club to establish training camps for its students, and last August, it appointed a former Eton School deputy head as chairman of its board. In its statement, Rider said Kaiwen will offer employment to current faculty and staff and continue student aid, adding that the buyer is committed to Westminster's long-term viability. While the announcement made public the name of the group that could take over Westminster, it did not sway opponents of the sale, who have argued that Rider does not have the right to sell the land. Earlier this week, prior to Rider's most recent announcement, Princeton Theological Seminary filed suit against the university, contending that the effort to sell the choir college may have disregarded the conditions set by the land's donor. Sophie Strong Taylor gifted the land to Westminster in the 1930s on the condition that if it ever ceased to operate as a choir college, the land would go to the seminary. Rider bought Westminster and merged it into its own programs in 1992. In its suit, the seminary contended it had been kept at arm's length, despite efforts to reach out to Rider for information on the negotiations. Matt Collar is a member of the Coalition to Save Westminster Choir College.
We believe that the sale is illegal and that it violates the merger agreement, and that has damaged the school significantly in terms of enrollment, which is way down. The number of donations, I believe, has pretty much dropped to zero to the school, and the accreditation issues and faculty loss. We've already lost several faculty members, and we know that several are in the process of looking elsewhere. So, you know, the damage has been pretty extensive.
Student and alumni reactions to the announcement on social media were mixed, expressing both concern about the ultimate goals of Kaiwen in taking on a choir college with little experience, and also optimism about the international and cultural opportunities that might emerge from such a combination. Vocal performance major Corinne Bernson is a moderator of the Keep Westminster Choir College in Princeton Facebook group and secretary of the Class of 19. She said the announcement, which students received as an email during the school day on Wednesday, at least answered some of their questions.
I think we are more open-minded to maybe some change occurring based on this new person, this new buyer, and what they could possibly bring to our school. So I think we just really, we're still very curious and we want to meet them, ask questions, but having the name has been able to open up some sort of research and opening our minds up a little bit more. I know on some of the more public forums, we have had a few Chinese alums that have been able to give us some insight, translating a few things on the website for us, giving us a little bit more information. But now that we know who they are, I think we want to be able to be more collaborative and part of the process. But I think overall, the feeling is more positive because I think we're happy that we're more involved a little bit.
Burnson added that the students will send questions to Del Amo through the student government's executive board. In its announcement, Ryder also said Kaiwen has tapped consultant Catherine Jarzizian to assist with the process of obtaining accreditation from the National Association of Schools of Music, a requirement, and Larry Livingston, chair of the Department of Conducting at the University of Southern California's Thornton School of Music and former dean of the Shepherd School of Music at Rice University, as a project manager and liaison. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. The legacy and impact of Leonard Bernstein was felt well outside the Symphony Concert Hall. His outreach to young people inspired a deep interest in music in students, whether or not they chose it as their career. And a prominent social activist, he was often guided by his conscience to bring his music and influence to support the social causes in which he believed. Those are among the topics that will be explored through an upcoming exhibition at Philadelphia's National Museum of American Jewish History. The exhibit opens next month and is entitled The Power of Music, taking visitors through Bernstein's life, his relationship with his faith and Jewish identity, and his social activism. In connection with that, the museum has teamed up with the Curtis Institute of Music and Opera Philadelphia for a roundtable discussion March 1st that will focus on how Bernstein's identity shaped his last opera, A Quiet Place, which will be performed later in the month by the Curtis Opera Theater and Opera Philadelphia. Ivy Weingram is the exhibition's curator at the museum, which year-round includes Bernstein among its 20 standout American Jewish figures of the past three centuries. She said much of the exhibit and the roundtable reflect Bernstein's quest through his music to answer the questions of the 20th century's crisis of faith.
He was always searching for a solution to the crisis of faith, by which I think he meant a few different things. Faith in God, you know, a spiritual, a religious component to his faith, as well as faith in his fellow man and faith in government and in our nation's leaders. You know, he lived through a very challenging period in American and world history, through World War II and the Holocaust, the civil rights movement, the Vietnam era, a lot of social change. And these all tested his faith in innumerable ways, and we see that come out in his work. So the exhibition pays particular attention to key moments and works, and examines his life, you know, through his search through that crisis. And when we team up with Curtis and Opera Philadelphia on a program about A Quiet Place, we're really talking about identity issues. And there were a number of ways in which Bernstein's own identity would be challenged throughout his life. And, you know, of course, as the National Museum of American Jewish History, we are in a great position to pay particular attention to his Jewish identity, the way that that framed the kind of man and composer and social activist that he became.
What are some of the questions you expect to be raised as part of the roundtable conversation?
I expect that we'll talk about Bernstein's Jewish identity. I expect that we'll talk about his sexual identity and also his social activism, which was really at the heart of, I think, everything he did, from his music to his politics as well.
What were some of the things that you learned more about in terms of the way Bernstein expressed particularly his Jewish identity through his music?
Bernstein was raised in the Jewish community of Boston. His parents were Ukrainian Jewish immigrants, and he learned a love and an appreciation for Jewish history and prayer and texts from his father, Samuel Bernstein, who was very involved in their synagogue, Congregation Mishkan Tefillah, the conservative congregation in the Boston area, still around today, particularly the music that Leonard Bernstein was exposed to in services of Mishkan Tefillah. He said that the music that the cantor and the music director at his childhood synagogue caused to be made was among the greatest that he'd ever heard. It was among that which moved him most deeply. And this is after he had really become Leonard Bernstein and conducted in Carnegie Hall and around the world. We'll have a special interactive installation in our exhibition that allows visitors to explore some of the Jewish origins of Bernstein's work, particularly, you know, secular works like works for Broadway or for symphony orchestra. So you'll get to play around with the melodies that he borrowed and riffed on, that he heard in the synagogue as a child and which stayed with him through a lifetime.
What are some of the other things that will be on display as part of the exhibit?
You'll find a number of Bernstein's personal effects, including probably the greatest of all, his piano, a piano that was given to him by his piano instructor, Helen Coates, when he was a teenager. We're so excited to be able to display that piano on loan from his family. We have a copy of Romeo and Juliet that Leonard Bernstein and Jerome Robbins annotated as they were starting to think about how to transform Shakespeare's classic into the West Side Story that we know today. So you see their notes in the margins of Romeo and Juliet. We'll have scene sketches from early versions of that, you know, iconic American theater piece. So I'm particularly excited to bring some of that behind-the-scenes story of West Side Story to the public. We'll have the tools of his trade, the easel that he used to compose and mark up scores, his pencils, his glasses, his ashtray, all the things that he surrounded himself with in his studio, as well as a number of his writings and iconic photographs of him. It's a peek into his life, both personal and professional.
What have been some of the ways that you found he did struggle with these questions of faith and the way that came through in his music?
I think one of the most striking examples of the way that he married or he worked through this crisis of faith in his music is in his Mass. He composed Mass for the opening of the Kennedy Center in 1971, and he worked with lyricist Stephen Schwartz to reimagine this Catholic rite as a theater piece. And through both the music and obviously the theme, you really see the composer struggling with his faith. He uses a number of different kinds of music in this monumental piece, which requires over 200 performers, rock musicians, orchestra musicians, the children's choir and adult choir, dancers, you know, the clash of these types of music in some ways in and of itself represents that struggle with faith, how to preserve your faith when it seems like the world around you is crumbling. And remember, this premiered during the Vietnam War, and he was very, very against the war. And as a piece itself, as a Mass, of course, it also, the celebrant of the Mass is in some ways a stand-in for the composer himself, wrestling with his own faith and the contemporary voices that seek to sort of break down his faith and instill a lot of doubt, and how that is, his faith withers over the course of the performance, but somehow ends on a hopeful note, so to speak.
That was Ivy Weingram, curator of Leonard Bernstein, The Power of Music, which will open at the National Museum of American Jewish History in Philadelphia March 16th and run through September 2nd. More information is available at nmajh.org. The museum will host its roundtable in partnership with the Curtis Institute of Music and Opera Philadelphia. In addition to Weingram, the panelists will include Michael Eliason, artistic director of the Curtis Opera Theater and artistic advisor to Opera Philadelphia, composer Jennifer Higdon, film, opera, and theater director Daniel Fish, and Ashley Milanese, a member of Curtis Opera Theater and an Opera Philadelphia emerging artist. A Quiet Place premiered in 1983 as a one-act opera that served as a sequel to Bernstein's earlier work, Trouble in Tahiti. Over the years, it went through some revisions, including a three-act adaptation that incorporated elements from Trouble in Tahiti through flashbacks. The performance in Philadelphia will be the American premiere of a staged version. Eliasson said the opera provides plenty of material for discussion about families and identity.
It's about a family who is gathering together after the death of the mother. It's based on the characters from an opera that he wrote much early on called Trouble in Tahiti. And we now meet these characters many years later at the funeral of the mother. There are many theater pieces, there are many operas that are built around the dysfunction of a family. Maybe, for example, something like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf by Albee comes to mind. There are many operas that are about, I would say, The Ring by Richard Wagner is definitely, it's somehow about a very dysfunctional family. And it's the same thing with A Quiet Place is also about a totally dysfunctional family. He wrote it towards the end of his life, where he was quite tormented in his own personal life. His wife and his ex-wife was dying, and he had a lot of personal problems, etc. and so forth. And some of this is coming out in A Quiet Place and is reflected in A Quiet Place in a most unique way. It's a libretto by Stephen Wadsworth. It's kind of an amazing piece, an amazing theater piece. I guess the allure of it is that it's Bernstein and the kind of music that he writes, but also that we are always attracted to these dysfunctional families. I mean, we just have to go to soap operas, for example, and there we have it. We are attracted to this and how to solve these problems and what to do with them, what to do with these people and so on. So it's been a huge challenge. This is the American premiere of the stage version of this version of A Quiet Place. There have been several versions of A Quiet Place since it's originated. And this is a gift to Curtis, in a way, from the Bernstein estate. They asked if I would be interested in doing it to celebrate his 100th anniversary. And he went to school here. So, of course, I was quite interested in presenting it.
Well, musically, looking at the production, the opera, where would you say it fits within a broader operatic repertoire in terms of its style and what the performers have to focus on?
The great thing about Bernstein is that you just have to play two or three bars and you know it's Bernstein. Whether that's in one of his symphonies, and, you know, there are sort of two Bernsteins. There's the Broadway Bernstein, you know, the West Side Story, On This Town, and that kind of world that we recognize as Bernstein. But there's also the other Bernstein, which is in the three symphonies, for example, in his ballet scores, Dybbuk and so on, where we also recognize him as recognize the Bernstein. So it's this amalgamation between these two worlds, which I think is very intriguing and very interesting in how he does this in A Quiet Place. You know, he never wanted to be just known as the composer of West Side Story. He wanted to be known also as a composer of quote-unquote serious classical concert music, I should say. My own opinion, of course, is that I do believe that the great American opera is West Side Story, whether he would agree with that or not. But it's very recognizably Bernstein. There's great moments of levity. There's great moments of quite tremendous depth. And I think it's a fantastic piece. And it's a mystery to me that it has not been more performed. And I'm hoping that this production under Daniel Fish, the stage director, and conducted by Corrado Ruveras, the music director of the Opera of Philadelphia, I'm hoping that it will sort of spur on people to wanna do it.
How often is it presented in some form within American operas?
Well, I don't think it's been presented very much here in this country, but as I said, I think it's been played in concert version. By Kent Nagano and his ensemble. But in this country, there was a version of it, not the version that we're doing was done at New York City Opera maybe 7-8 years ago, which was the first time that it had been presented in New York City, actually. It's a dark piece, I would say. But then, of course, lots of operas are dark because very often in traditional 19th century opera, 18th century opera, there's someone who dies at the end, of course, you know, whether it's Mimi or Tosca or whoever, you know. But this is the opera actually starts with the death of someone. So maybe that's in reverse. But I think it's very much a theater piece. And it's filled with a lot of the issues that Bernstein was obsessed with, you know, about what is life all about, what are the relationships between people. But it's the same issues that essentially, for example, somebody like Wagner was also inside. They're very different. I'm not comparing the music at all, but there is definitely sort of, I do think there's a kind of a similarity in the obsession about how to present these things on stage.
That was Michael Eliason, Artistic Director of the Curtis Opera Theater and Artistic Advisor to Opera Philadelphia. Performances will be held at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts in Philadelphia March 7th, 9th, and 11th, and at Hunter College's K Playhouse in New York City, March 13th. The Curtis Institute has its own historic ties to Bernstein, who graduated from Curtis. In addition to the performance of A Quiet Place and The Roundtable, Curtis is presenting a nationwide tour featuring the Zora String Quartet and other performers that kicked off February 10th and is traveling around the U.S. through March 18th. Curtis also has posted articles about Bernstein and photos from its archives on its website. David Ludwig is chair of composition studies at Curtis, and I spoke with him about Bernstein's time there and his legacy.
He came to Curtis, I think, right around 1940, after being at Harvard. And he was just there for a couple of years, but he made a big impact. He studied conducting, piano. He studied orchestration. The director of Curtis at the time was a composer named Randall Thompson, who was involved as well with Harvard. You know, so he worked with him. And I think he benefited a lot from his time at Curtis and from really focusing very much on music. But I also think he was already at that point ready to go off and kind of make his mark in the world.
Well, conversely, are there ways, looking back now, that he and his subsequent work have impacted and left their own legacy on Curtis?
Well, I mean, no question, simply that the impact that Bernstein left on American music is one that I think is felt everywhere, but particularly at Curtis, where there's really a cultivation of young musicians who are both really extremely focused on their work, but have a broad range of interests and influences. And in that sense, Bernstein is really a role model for all of us. And, you know, speaking for the institution, I think he's a role model for the study of music in that he was such a great, great advocate for this concert music that we're so passionate about.
What were some of the things that Curtis really wanted to emphasize and bring to light as it celebrated this 100th year anniversary of his birth?
Well, you know, you start with his music. And I think that, you know, as a composer, this is what's most important to me. And I'm sure his music, I know his music was extremely important to him. So to celebrate his music, to program it and perform it with these really astonishingly gifted young musicians, I think is a really excellent way of commemorating or paying him tribute. Beyond that, I think the fact that the school is putting a lot of effort into making its connection to Bernstein and to celebrating his impact on American music in many of the ways that you just said, I think is very important.
I wanted to talk a bit about that collaboration with Opera Philadelphia and the National Museum of American Jewish History. What is Curtis bringing to that collaboration, and why was that particular angle exploring aspects of his identity and how he explored his identity through that work?
Well, his Bernstein's identity, like I think many composers, the identity manifests itself on the page. And so even just from a strictly musical point of view, acknowledging his identity and what was important to him, I think is really important in understanding Bernstein's tradition. I think that everyone involved wants to honor, you know, where he's coming from and honor his perspective. I think the idea that politics and art or identity and art don't mix is really a not very well-informed perspective, because this has been true since really people started creating art, that they put themselves into it and their own perspective and their own beliefs and belief system. So I think this is all part and parcel to celebrating the man himself.
What was it in particular about A Quiet Place that made that the appropriate performance vehicle?
This opera is something that has never really been done in this form. So it's an opportunity for us as musicians and really lifelong students of music to explore something new of Bernstein's and to bring it out. I think that alone, the kind of musical artistic curiosity, is a great motivator for putting this on. I mean, it's a very interesting, provocative, beautiful piece of music that very much deserves to be brought to the public.
Well, there are a number of works in which Bernstein explicitly brings in Jewish roots, his Jewish heritage, certainly the Kaddish symphony, Chichester Psalms to some extent, and also some liturgical pieces that he's done as well. How did he explore his Jewish roots and his Jewish heritage through his music?
That's a great question. I'm also a Jewish composer, so this is something I think about a lot and think a lot about how different composers have approached this. There are some who have, you know, really spent a long time with the liturgy, and others who have just kind of felt, you know, we look at Gershwin, for instance, and a lot of Porgy and Bess has some very direct Hebrew chant, actually, in there, and a lot of traditional Jewish and Hebrew influences. I think for Bernstein, as far as I know his work, and he was, I think, pretty close with my family, so I, you know, got to know him secondhand, at least. I think his identity as a Jew was extremely important to him, and he was outspoken in many ways about it. So it makes sense that he would then focus on some of that in his work. It's both, you know, something that he would have grown up having around him, and something that as time went on and through a very, I think, difficult, obviously, 20th century, it's something that he needed to advocate for and speak about.
That was David Ludwig, Chair of Composition Studies at the Curtis Institute of Music. You can find more information on its Bernstein Centenary events, including the roundtable at the museum and performances of A Quiet Place, at curtis.edu/Bernstein. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world each week on A Tempo. Remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.